The way your scores are all done is from as a percentage of the high score in the class. So I kind of don't even know what the score, maximum score theoretically would be. The score that achieved the high score was 145. So then your score is a fraction of 145, and the grade is then determined by that little cheat that was sitting there that figures out what letter grade corresponds to the number. The fraction is what counts. I mean, that's what I'm going to grade, that's what I'm going to average in the end, not the letter scores per se, but the letter score tells you where that's going to fit in eventually. So it was a funny exam compared to previous exams. So there were lots of A's, lots of B's, but what was funny about it is there were pretty much as many F's as there were A's, and I've never had that happen before. So I don't know what happened to have such a quote-unquote nice symmetrical bell-shaped curve. Questions? So as usual, the answers are there as screencasts if you want to go over it. If you've got questions now, though, that's good, too. Okay, so you can see that we're kind of continuing something that would have driven Aristotle crazy, right? The idea that we can study the heavens by doing stuff here on Earth doesn't fit in with the idea that the quintessence is totally different from the four elements. And we've been dealing with how people figured that out. Basically 100 years of astronomy from Copernicus till Newton. And Newton's stuff, while we wouldn't say it's perfectly correct today, it's awfully accurate for normal sorts of situations. And we talked about Newton's laws two times ago. The ones that are going to be particularly important for us is that today is that the change in velocity is caused by forces. If there's no force, there'll be no change in velocity. So his first law is straight line motion forever in the absence of forces. And a particular formula for the force of gravity. And we talked about Galileo. Again, a couple of times ago, Galileo was important for his telescopic observations. But he also did work in what we would call mechanics and how bodies behave here on the surface of the Earth. And famously, he may or may not, at least is reputed to have his earliest biography claims, he threw heavy objects and light objects off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and they fell together, much to the surprise of the Aristotelians. Incidentally, much to the surprise of Galileo, of the earlier version of Galileo, we have writings from Galileo where he says that he took heavy objects and light objects and threw them from his window, and they fell at different rates. He was, of course, a teacher of Aristotle early in his career. So how all of these people got this wrong for so long is kind of a surprise. And in fact, backwards. That is to say, the common impression was that a piece of wood would fall faster than a piece of iron, which is very much contrary to the case. So we talked about orbiting. So all that's necessary to orbit is to throw something real fast. If the Earth were really flat, then a bullet dropped and a bullet thrown would hit the ground at the same time. But with a curved Earth, the possibility is that the distance it falls every second is going to be made up for by the curvature of the Earth, so that it can have the same altitude all the time. And what's required for that is just moving horizontally really fast, about 17,000 miles an hour. If you're moving a little bit slower than the required orbital speed, then you will approach the Earth. If you don't approach close enough to hit it, then you will complete an elliptical orbit. So you then start at the far point, the apogee, and far away we're going to have the perigee, our closest approach. If you have too fast a speed, more than 17,000 miles an hour, then you go out for a while, and you'll just come back in and complete an elliptical orbit. So there's a perfect circular orbital speed. If you're a little bit above it or a little bit below it, you'll just have an elliptical orbit, assuming that your orbit doesn't intersect the surface of the Earth. If you go the square root of 2 times faster, 25,000 miles an hour, then you'll go and you won't come back. So that's called the escape velocity. And we also talked about something that, again, Galileo got wrong, the tides. So there are two high tides per day, which mean that there are two bulges of the ocean, one more or less pointing towards the moon and one more or less pointing away from it. It actually leads the moon by a little bit because of the rotation of the Earth. The moon's the main contributor to the tides, but everything that has a gravitational force will contribute to it a little bit. The moon doesn't weigh nearly as much as the sun, but it's a lot closer, so it turns out to be the leading figure. But the sun has an effect. So if the sun and the moon are acting together, as would be the case in a full moon or a new moon, then we're going to have unusually large tides, which are called spring tides. If we have the moon and the sun at odds with each other, as you would in one of the quarter phases, then we have unusually small tides called neap tides. And the reason it's not exactly 12 hours apart is, of course, the moon is a moving target. So one rotation later, the moon will have moved on a little bit, and so the high tide will occur at a slightly later time. Questions about any of that? Well, so in my mind, about the neatest demonstration you can have is this one. Pretty neat, huh? So what's happening in that circumstance where we have this ball being pulled by the string? So first of all, if I'm actually doing this, I can feel that I'm pulling in on this ball. So as this ball is going around in a circle, the force I'm applying is towards the center of the circle. Now, you've learned this swear word sometime in your life called centrifugal. And you have a tendency to think that things are pushed out. But not so, things are pushed in. So I would be really happy if you would take this word centrifugal and just delete it from your vocabulary. It's a word that doesn't mean anything, or at least it doesn't mean anything that's true. So if you like to believe that the Earth doesn't go around the sun, then you can hang on to the word centrifugal, because they have about the same sort of context. They're both seemingly correct statements that are false. So the real force that's required in order to move this thing in a circle is a center pointing force, and it's called a centripetal. Very similar sounding word, opposite meaning, a center pointing force. So you know that when something is, the Earth is orbiting the sun, it's going in a circle very much like this ball, and the thing that's playing the role of the string is the force of gravity that is pulling the Earth constantly towards the center. And it seems like the wrong idea. So we know what Kepler thought. Kepler thought that we kind of needed angels to push the Earth around in a circle that way. But it's not true. We need the Earth to be pushed constantly towards the sun, but constantly missing the sun. So one way Newton had to try and convince people of this was by considering kind of a funny version of pool. So if you consider a multi-sided pool table, you can imagine a pool shot that looks like this, right? That goes around more or less in a circle. And of course, what's happening, every time the ball hits the rail, it's being pushed towards the center. And if you kind of think of more and more sides on your pool table, you get closer and closer to the approximation of actually moving in a circle. And what one can show, doesn't take too much algebra to do this, the change in velocity, the acceleration that's occurring, depends on the speed you're going and the radius of the circle you're going in. So if I try and spin this thing real fast in a real small circle, I can feel that the string is really taut. Whereas if I have this thing moving at a relatively slow velocity in a relatively big circle, the corresponding force is going to be small. So this is called the centripetal acceleration. It's the acceleration that something has when it's going in a circle. So I can remember as a kid being told lots of incorrect things by my parents. And one of them had to do with another word that you'd be well to delete from your vocabulary, inertia. I don't know what it means, but I certainly know that my parents lied to me when they told me what was going on in the car. So when my dad hit the gas, I got pushed back in the seat, and I was told that it was inertia that was pushing me back. And that's not what's happening. So here's the seat. Here's my body. What's happening, of course, is when we're going on the gas, as I'm accelerating, and what's happening is the springs in the seat are being compressed in order to provide the force that's necessary to push me forward. So I'm being pushed forward by the seat. Right? Otherwise, my velocity wouldn't change. If there were no force on me, I would go on a straight line forever at a constant speed. If my speed is going to change, there has to be a force that's doing it, and it has to be something that's more or less in contact with me. The thing that's in contact with me is the seat. So the seat is the thing that's pushing me forward. Nothing is pushing me back. I'm being pushed forward. Okay, so inside the car, here are my books piled up, and my dad makes a turn that away. And the books go flying into the car wall, and the story is that it's centrifugal force that has pushed them there. Not the case. So what was happening before they started to slip is the frictional force was pushing them that away, letting them change their velocity, providing the centripetal force that was required to move them in a circle. But there's a limited amount of frictional force. The frictional force became insufficient to move it in this circle, so the book started to go in a straight line, and the car door hit them. The books weren't doing anything special. It was the car door that ran into them, not the books that ran into the car door. Okay, so there's a maximum extent for frictional forces. So I'm told that the best sort of demos are the ones that have some potential of embarrassing the person doing the talking. So you can see I'm nervous. Right, so you take some of your favorite beverage on Valentine's Day, right? Diet Coke. And supposedly, the frictional force has some maximum value. And if I put this on here and I slide the thing out from under it, there'll be some maximum frictional force, but it won't have much of an effect on the object. And it'll more or less sit there. This can go wrong. Should I say this has gone wrong? Well, let's see. And I actually couldn't find my favorite cloth beforehand, so untested. Who knows? More or less. Thank you. I don't know, you actually were hoping for the reverse, right? So I don't know why you're clapping. Okay, so, right, so this is part two, right? So, can this thing be held upside down and over my head and not get me wet? Where are you at? Kind of like the Mamet comet. Well, we'll get to that too. All right, so yeah, it can be. So there's kind of a similar sort of situation. I'm sure you've seen at various rides, the motorcycle that rides upside down. And of course, the motorcycle better not start too low, or else bad things happen. So what's happening in all of these cases that seemingly the answer is the centrifugal force is pushing it up, right? And holding it to the railing, but that doesn't get a lot of credit on exams. So wouldn't want to say that. Well, let's use our imaginations and imagine Superman. I didn't see it working. Superman. Okay. So here's this bucket of water. There's the cape. And here's Superman holding that bucket of water, flying down towards the Earth. And imagine what happens if Superman isn't going very fast, right? Maybe he's going 1 mile an hour. Well, you know the water is going to fall faster than 1 mile an hour. It's going to leave the bucket. But what happens if Superman is going faster than the acceleration of gravity? So the water will stay in the bucket. So all that's necessary for all of these things to work is to have the acceleration at the top of these arcs, what acceleration? This acceleration, be more than the acceleration of gravity, be more than the rate at which something would fall normally. Under all those circumstances, the water is going to stay in the bucket. Okay. Well, so how does this all, you know, contrary to Aristotle, how does this all apply to the planets? So the planets are moving in more or less circular orbits, and we claim that this is the force, the centripetal force, that's pushing them around in a circle. Or maybe I should say pulling them around in a circle, because it's a central force. And we know that the force divided by the mass is supposed to give us the acceleration. So if I think about the sun and a planet, might be the Earth, might be Pluto, orbiting around it, we know the central force is going to be Newton's gravitational constant times the mass of the sun times the mass of the planet divided by the distance between their centers squared. And I'm supposed to take that force and divide it by the mass of the planet. And all of that is supposed to equal the acceleration. And so we notice, as we have in the past, the mass of the planet actually doesn't play any particular role. The mass of the thing in the center is the thing that plays the leading role. And what we have here then is that g times the mass of the sun divided by r squared is equal to the velocity, miles per hour, that the planet is traveling divided by r. And we can rearrange this a little bit. We can cancel off one of these r's, take the square root. And lo and behold, we have the relationship that Pluto, since it has a bigger r in the denominator, is going to be traveling at fewer miles per hour than Mercury would be. But this isn't quite what Kepler came up with. So you remember Kepler said that the time it takes to go around the sun depended upon the radius of the orbit to the 3/2 power. So how is that going to work out? So here we've got the speed that we're orbiting at. The time it takes to go around, all we have to do is take the distance you need to go and divide it by the speed. And the distance you need to go around in a circle is the circumference of the circle. And we've said that the velocity is given by that result. So what we've got is 2 pi over the square root of gm. So this is something that's in the denominator of the denominator, so it can come upstairs. And r times the square root of r, that's exactly what we mean by r to the 3/2. So Kepler's third law is explained by Newton's laws plus centripetal acceleration. It's a bit of a pain to show that elliptical orbits happen if you're not at exactly orbital speed, but it is also just a consequence of Newton's laws. So we got left that funny aerial velocity. How is that related to anything in particular? Particularly to Newton's laws. Well, that leads to kind of a long discussion about what are called conservation laws. So these are not like seasons on when you can fish or something like that. These are rules of nature that guarantee that something is going to be held constant. Conservation as in held the same. And like lots of these laws, they're going to be hypotheses. There's going to be an if part and a then part. But there are three big conservation laws that are consequences of Newton's equations. Newton didn't think about it this way as far as we can figure out. He probably knew about these, but he never wrote them down as being particularly important. And these days we do think about them as being particularly important. So these are conservation of energy, momentum, and angular momentum. And it's really the top ones and the bottom ones that are going to play a big role for us. And probably the singular most important law in all of science is the conservation law of energy. So the idea of conservation of energy is that in that complicated motion, which nothing seems the same, there is something that's actually held constant. So in that motion, what happened is the ball started with some speed, it slowed down as it went up, and then it speeded up as it hit the ground, then it bounced a few times, and it came to rest. So I don't know, what could be at all constant in all of that stuff? And it took, as I say, it took a good long time to figure out that there was something that was constant in all of that stuff. And the only way it's going to be possible is if we think of energy as coming in lots of different forms, some of which are visible and some of which are not particularly visible. And I'm going to want to talk initially about three types of energy. We've got kinetic energy, we've got potential energy, and we've got thermal energy. And we can add lots of other ones in the future. So kinetic energy is the obvious one. It has a simple formula. It's just 1/2 the speed squared. So initially this ball had lots of kinetic energy, but the kinetic energy was decreasing as it went up. So kinetic energy by itself certainly wasn't a constant. So we're not there yet. Potential energy. So potential energy is energy that you can't see. It's stored energy. So the energy that's in the battery of your laptop is potential energy. In some sense, the energy that's in the food that you're still digesting is potential energy. And typically we associate potential energy with some sort of force which is out of equilibrium. So if I take this ball and I lift it, somehow I've gotten I put a certain amount of energy simply by the position of this ball that I can get back if I let it fall. So you might know that there are electrical stations that simply pump water uphill when there's extra energy, and then they let that let the water fall back down and drive the generators and get the energy back. So we can store energy in lots of various forms. And the form that's going to be of particular importance to us is going to be gravitational potential energy. So that's the energy that this ball has simply because it's in this higher position than it had when it's down there. So when the ball was going up, it's trading kinetic energy for potential energy. Less and less kinetic energy, more and more potential energy, until it has no more kinetic energy left. It's at rest, instantaneously at the top of its flight. And then it does the reverse. It trades potential energy for kinetic energy. The potential energy gets less and less and less, and the kinetic energy gets more and more and more. And there's a trade-off. Now, kind of confusingly, the usual form when we think of gravitational potential energy, we think of it as always being negative. Because the maximum gravitational potential energy we could have is if things were infinitely separated. And they could be infinitely separated in lots of different ways. So the gravitational potential energy, turns out that that's a good formula for it. So if we have the planet and the sun separated by a big distance, the gravitational potential energy is zero, the maximum separation. As they get closer and closer together, we're going downhill into more and more negative range. Now, if you don't have very big changes in height, if I'm just throwing something up and down in this room, then I can just talk about the change in potential energy being related to the change in height. So there are lots of forms of potential energy that we could write down. There's chemical potential energy, electrical potential energy, magnetic potential energy. Every imaginable force has a corresponding potential energy. So chemical potential energy turns out is mostly in the electrical behavior of the electrons that are making up the atom. So it's a type of electrical potential energy. Nuclear potential energy has to do with the nuclear force. Okay, so energy can be invisibly stored in various force fields, and for us, most importantly, in the gravitational force field. And we can trade off kinetic energy for potential energy. So if we want to calculate the escape velocity, what we need to say is we need to give the object so much kinetic energy that it can overcome, it can get over this barrier, it can get over the hill that is the gravitational potential energy well. So you can think about, here is the gravitational potential, here we sit at the surface of the Earth, we need to give it enough kinetic energy to make it over the hill. And if we do the calculation, which we're not gonna bother to do, it turns out that the escape velocity is the square root of 2 times the orbital velocity. So not hugely more. Just 40% more. So historically, it's kind of funny. So the first spacecraft to orbit the Earth, I think it was like 1957, 1956, something like that. Very soon after that, people were sending probes to Mars and to the Moon because it wasn't that much harder to go to those very distant places than it was to just to orbit the Earth. Just 40% more speed is all that was required. Thermal energy. So you know, there's this power plant over there, and what they do is they burn stuff, coal, gas, and they get something hot, and somehow or other they're able to convert that hot stuff into electrical energy. So there's energy and heat. Heat is a form of energy. And as I say, we could add lots of things to this list of types of energy. Sound is a type of energy. Light is a type of energy. All of these things are types of energy. So in the end, what we have is the ball on the ground with zero speed. So it doesn't have any more potential energy, doesn't have any more kinetic energy. So what happened to all the energy? Well, it went into these forms. When it hit the ground, you heard it. And you know that when you bang into the carpet repeatedly, you're going to heat it a little bit. So all of the energy that was originally in kinetic energy was converted for a while into potential energy, came back to kinetic energy. All of that energy in the end led to a little bit of sound and a little bit of heating of the rug. But otherwise, total amount of energy is still there. Right, so the big project to conserve energy is not required, right? It's automatically conserved for us, right? However much energy you buy from NSP, it's still there. But it's in a very disorganized form, and you kind of can't put Humphrey Dumphrey back together again, right? You can't collect all of that thermal energy that's now just slightly above room temperature where the ball hit and put it back to project the ball back at high speed. The energy is in a pretty disorganized form, and so it's hard to get it organized again back into kinetic energy. So this distinction between organized energy and disorganized thermal energy has a lot to do with this word entropy and the so-called second law of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics you already know, it's conservation of energy. The second law of thermodynamics roughly says that once things are in this disorganized state, you can't bring them back. And the particular word for this is entropy, the disorganized nature of the universe. Disorganization always increases. So if you clean up your room, you disorganized other parts of the universe in order to do that. Well, we'll come back to second law of thermodynamics in kind of more practical applications. But as I say, that's why we can't take the, you might know that there's a nuclear power station in Monticello. What happens is that it dumps a lot of heat into Mississippi, which is near the power plant, but we can't take that heat and get more energy out of it. We can't make some sort of perpetual motion by recycling that energy. And the reason is because the second law of thermodynamics, there's no way of taking that disorganized motion and putting it back together. Okay, so conservation of energy is going to play a huge role. It's probably the single most important law of science. How about these other relationships? Momentum. So kind of the usual example of momentum is to think about the process of on ice skates. Why you would ever do this, I don't know, but makes a nice story. So we're going to shoot a gun, a rifle, while we're on ice skates. If you ever shot a gun, you know what happens, right? The gun goes slamming into your shoulder. So what's happening, of course, is Newton's third law, right? The gun is putting a force on the bullet, and so the bullet is going to put a force on you, and it's going to drive you back. And there's something that's equal and opposite about this. However much momentum the bullet gets, that same amount of momentum is going to end up in you. Not so obviously, because you weigh a lot more than the bullet. Right? So even though the forces are the same, they can have radically different consequences. Right? So if you throw the baby in front of the semi-truck, moving at 60 miles an hour, there's exactly the same force of the truck on the baby as on the baby on the truck. But they're kind of radically different consequences for that force. So it's kind of the same thing. The light thing, the baby, is going to be given a big velocity, and the truck is going to hardly be affected at all. But it will be affected a little bit. Much, you know, might lose a tenth of a mile an hour as a result. So what happens here is that we get positive momentum in the bullet, and we have, a simple formula for momentum. It's just the mass times the speed. So we're going to have a big speed and a small mass to add up to a modicum of momentum, and the recoil is going to result in a big mass having a relatively small velocity in the other direction. Now, in order to tell this story, I had to put this person on ice, etc. So there's an if part of the conservation of momentum. So if there are no external forces, then momentum, which is mass times velocity, is going to be conserved. So there are some external forces, so this thing doesn't work perfectly, but I'm sure you've seen these little games before. What's going to happen here is this ball is going to hit a ball that weighs exactly as much, and there will be a force between them which is just enough to bring this guy to rest and bring the second guy to exactly the same speed that the first one was going to. It very quickly hits the second one and the third one and the fourth one, and so we get a situation where it sure looks like we have action at a distance sort of thing. But there is an external force, friction, that is slowly slowing this thing down. Okay, so if there are no external forces, then momentum is going to be a constant. So there's potential here for, you know, a real neat sort of rocket. So imagine that I'm in my spacecraft moving at some particular speed with no external forces present. So I have some momentum that is the mass times velocity. Now, contrary to fact, if I could somehow reduce my mass, then automatically my speed would have to go up to compensate for it, right? Because the product would have to be a constant. But, you know, losing your mass isn't quite that easy. So that trick doesn't work for linear momentum. But we actually can play a very similar game with angular momentum. So angular momentum is just like linear momentum, except in circles as opposed to a straight line. That makes any sense. So instead of speed, we're going to talk about rotation rate, RPMs. The more RPMs, the more angular momentum that you're going to have. And we're going to have something that plays a role like mass, and it's usually denoted by I. I'll just write RPMs for the rotation rate. This thing, which it's helpful to have a name for it, unfortunately it uses a swear word. It's called the moment of inertia. That's an I, doesn't really look like it. What that's playing a role of is it's not just mass that determines how things rotate. So, now I have a wet piece of chalk. I bet it doesn't work as well as a dry piece of chalk. So it's very easy to rotate very quickly. Well, it's supposed to be. Yeah, very easy to rotate very quickly this ruler this way. But the same mass, trying to get it to rotate the other way, is much harder. I'm applying a much bigger force to try and rotate it that way. It's almost hurting my fingers than to do it that way. So it's easy to rotate something like this, and it's hard to rotate it like that. So this moment of inertia has to take into account that fact that the same mass object can be easy to rotate sometimes and hard to rotate other times. I don't know, so here's kind of another demonstration of that. So we've got two objects, and they've got the same mass. Which one of these do you think is easier to rotate than the other one?
The metal one.
This one's easy because it's got nothing inside. So we won't let me fake it. So I'll let gravity do the twisting. You can see that this one's easier to rotate. Now, I don't have a ball that's this big. Turns out that doesn't really matter. Which one of these do you think is easier to rotate? Close. I'm not sure I could see what happened. I know it's supposed to happen. They're not supposed to be the same, but they're pretty close to the same. It's the old problem that Galileo faced. You have to release them at the same time. Oh, that time it worked, right? This guy pulled ahead. So, what's the difference between these objects that makes this guy hard to rotate, this one easier, and this one easiest of all? And it's the same thing that makes it easy to rotate this way, but hard to rotate that way. Let it fall. It's just psychology below us. Actually, it's not. It's faculty below us. So what matters is kind of where the mass is. If we have mass that's at the periphery, it's harder to move than if the mass is on the axle. So we have to account not just for the mass, but where it's located, what the distribution of mass is. And very approximately speaking, and not particularly accurate, try and avoid that wet chalk, leave it for the next person. They're going to wonder, aren't they, when they pick up that wet piece of chalk. Very roughly speaking, the moment of inertia is kind of like the mass times the average radius. So here, all the mass is at the big radius. It couldn't be further apart. Here, there's some mass that's close, some mass that's closer to, that's at the edge. So the average radius is less than it is in this case. And in the case of the rolling ball, there's even more mass that's located close to the axis of rotation. Right? So if it's rotating like this, all of the mass here has hardly any rotation at all. Okay, so this quantity, moment of inertia times RPMs, that's supposed to be a constant if there are no external twists. Well, there's a $2 word for twisting force that's called torque, which if you look at the specs of automobile engines, you may have run into. But I'll write it, but certainly you don't need to know it. Okay, so their angular momentum is going to play a role, and we can do this sort of experiment for angular momentum, whereas we couldn't do it very well for the bullet case, because I have a device that has a pretty good situation of no external forces. So I've got this spin table that has pretty good ball bearings on it, and kind of like the air track that we used before, once it gets going, it goes forever because there's very little friction involved in it. So if I twist something when I'm on the spin table, I can give this thing some angular momentum, and the result should be that I should recoil the other way. So if I twist this way, I claim I'll twist the other way. You can see that it works. If I stop it, I stop, right? So to be more specific, so here's the spin table and here's my body. And what I did is I had this thing and I spun it one way and I had to reply the other way. Because I started with no angular momentum, no spin. This thing had some positive spin, so I had to have some negative spin in order to compensate. So this is a little bit boggling, but we'll see if it works. So I've got angular momentum now, but it's not on the axis that this thing can actually rotate. So it's basically zero angular momentum. If I just lift this thing up, I go one way. If I just put this thing down, I go the other way. If I bring it back to where it started, I stop. Incredible. So even though this thing was spinning sideways, it doesn't count because the thing can't rotate sideways. So this was spinning some particular direction, so it still added up to zero. When I brought this thing up, it had, let's call that positive spin, so I had to go the other way. Because it started with zero, it's conserved, so it has to stay zero. When I twist this thing around, and just by turning it upside down, it's now twisting the other way, that means I have to twist the other way. So something is a constant in this process. Well, the real trick is this space trip, is this spaceship trick, which we can do in angular results that we can't do in linear results. And that's because we have the possibility, while I can't change my mass easily, I can change my size easily. And you can see, if I somehow or other make my size a lot smaller, the spin rate has to increase in compensation. So you've all seen this at the Olympics or other sorts of skating arenas, right, where you see the skater start slowly spinning with the arms out, and as she brings her arms in close to her body, she spins a lot faster. But, you know, it's like the moon landing. It's all just done with special effects. It's not real. So, I don't know. So we need a volunteer. I mentioned this word vomit comet before. Who wants to be spun at high speeds? Okay.
That'd be a bad idea.
Come on. So we're gonna make the effect larger by putting some weights in your hands. So step up and start with your arms out. And let's make sure you're not gonna hit the wall. That's a little bit close. Step down and we'll move it over a foot. We don't care if you hit students, just don't hit the wall. The wall could be damaged. Okay, so slow spin, bring them in. Put them out as soon as you're about to vomit. Okay, so it more or less works. Okay, start with them out again. We'll undo it. Put them together. Put them apart. Put them together. So there's a little bit of friction. Put them apart. It does slow down eventually, luckily. There. It works. Applause. You did nothing. It was all physics. You don't deserve applause. So there's kind of a standard problem that people talk about of the, again, I'm not sure if you listened to Mark Vandehei, the astronaut who stopped by, but a concern and something they practice is what happens if the astronaut gets separated from the spacecraft and has no tether to pull them back. What can they do to somehow go this way, absent any jetpacks? And the answer is absolutely nothing unless they can get rid of something. You can twist all you want, but you can't push yourself forward. And there's nothing that astronaut can do by himself to get back to the spacecraft. But if he has a hammer and he throws the hammer this way, then automatically he's going to recoil that way and head back towards the space station. The hammer goes in orbit. And unfortunately, the hammer may come back and hammer the spacecraft at 17,000 miles an hour in the future. So they actually try and keep track of stuff that's lost so that they don't run into it. It's a big place, so it's unlikely. But there are literally tens of thousands of pieces of junk that are in orbit. It's actually a noticeable concern. They occasionally move the space station to avoid it. So you can't, if you don't get rid of something linearly, you can't solve the problem. But you know, how about the analogous problem with rotation? So what you do is you take your wife's cat and you hold it upside down and you drop it. And the cat, given enough space, it tends to bite you afterwards, but the cat somehow or other is able to change its angle without throwing anything away. Right? So the astronaut, unless he threw something away, could not change his position, but somehow the cat is able to change its angle without throwing anything away. And of course, there are no external twisting forces, so we're in a situation for conservation of angular momentum. So what's required? Well, it's pretty much the same story, right? So if the cat takes its tail and rotates it that way, then the body of the cat has to go the other way. And when its feet are down, it just stops rotating its tail, and it should stop, and it's all set. So I don't have a tail, but this can be my tail. So if I rotate my tail one way, I can change my angle. I can turn my back on you and then stop when I'm in the right direction. Okay, so it's all a matter of something being constant, conservation law. Namely, the conservation of angular momentum. And it turns out that this is exactly what's required for Kepler's second law about speed. So remember we said that when the planet is close, it's moving fast, whereas if it's far, it's moving slow. And this funny aerial velocity law is just about conservation of angular momentum. All that's happening is r squared times the RPMs is being constant as the planet goes around the sun. So something relatively simple is behind this kind of crazy aerial velocity law. Now there's one thing I haven't talked about a whole lot for a long time. And this came up on this guy. So remember, we've been saying for a long time that the whole celestial sphere rotates about this point that is close to the star Polaris, and that in our lifetimes that's always going to be the case. But that if we go read Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, he says the whole shebang is rotating about a star that's kind of near the star Tubin, but not particularly close. Too bad it isn't rotating in a more obvious fashion. And that's because the polar axis of the Earth is changing. There's a cycle that it goes through over tens of thousands of years. So what's the cause of that? Why is the Earth's spin axis changing? Well, the starting point maybe is to say why it's not changing. So why is the Earth spinning at a constant rate? Why doesn't it slow down the way that ball slowed down? Well, there's no frictional force on it. So it has a certain amount of angular momentum, and it's going to maintain that angular momentum unless there's an external torque, twisting force, that's acting on it. If there is a twisting force, then that angular momentum doesn't have to be constant. So the fact that the Earth's pole is changing, that means there must be somebody, you know, God's hands must be trying to twist the Earth in some funny way in order to change the orientation of the spin axis. And that's kind of a surprising feature. So let's kind of slow down maybe a little bit. Here we have kind of a model for something like the Earth. It can move this way, it can move that way, and it can spin. And if I have it set up right, it's more or less balanced so that it doesn't try and fall. And when it's in a balanced mode, like the Earth over our lifetime, it's a good gyroscope. So a gyroscope is a spinning device that always points in the same direction, no matter how the base is moved, because of conservation of angular momentum. So if I spin this guy up, then I can move around, and it continues to point in the same direction that it was pointing in initially. So long ago, they put gyroscopes on airplanes because a magnetic compass is not reliable, but a well-balanced gyroscope will point forever in the same direction. Okay, so that's what's happening to the Earth. In our lifetimes, it's not changing its direction because of conservation of angular momentum. But there is a small twisting force that's acting on the Earth. And that small twisting force is mostly the Moon. So here we have the Earth. Yeah, I'll incline its spin axis a little bit. And the Earth is not a perfect sphere. I hate to say because of centrifugal force, but it is bulging out at the equator a little bit. And of course, the Moon is one side or the other, and it's acting on this bulge to try and twist it in line. It's a very small effect. So to a good approximation, the angular momentum of the Earth is constant and the spin axis of the Earth doesn't change. But a very small torque acting on a twisting device can have kind of profound and funny consequences. So here we've got kind of a more standard toy gyroscope. And if I spin this guy up, yeah. The spin axis is constantly changing its direction. Pretty fast because there's a pretty big torque on it. So let's do that with this guy. If I have an unbalanced Earth, so it wants to fall, and I spin it up, instead of falling, it rotates. Yep. Not enough hands. Okay. You see that kind of up and down notion? That's called nutation, and the Earth's axis does that too. So it's pointing in different directions instead of falling. And I think the most dramatic demonstration of it seems very, very, to me, very surprising. So an ordinary bicycle wheel. Spin it. Doesn't fall. Instead of falling, it processes. The spin axis points in different directions at different times. If you come up here after lecture and you try and twist it, you'll see that it does really funny things. It doesn't do what you expect. When I try and twist it that way, it goes the other way. So gravity is obviously trying to twist this thing down, but the effect is 90 degrees away from it. It goes around in a circle. I know it's kind of hard to appreciate that. So I recommend that you come up and play with this after lecture. So here there's a little gyroscope, just like that toy, that's in this container, let's see. It won't roll. Right, the gyroscope wants to point in a fixed direction. It doesn't want to roll. If I stop the gyroscope, rolls perfectly well. So there's a funny force that acts on a spinning object so that it wants to point in the same direction. And if you try and make it not point in the same direction, it responds in a funny sort of way. So you would think that if the moon is going to try and twist the Earth this way, it would succeed. And the Earth's axis would end up perpendicular to the moon's orbit. But that's not what happens. Instead, the Earth's axis goes in this very slow precession, pointing in different directions at different times. So all of these subtle effects, Newton figured out in his own lifetime to explain how all of these funny notions, which had just been observed and not really understood, in fact worked in the real world. I may have gone through all of my toys. Questions?
You used an external force to get the gyroscope to work, right? Could you use an internal force, like an engine on the gyroscope, to get it to spin?
Yes and no. How's that for an answer? So let me back up for a second and comment. Rocket fuel is expensive. So you don't want to. So one way, if a space shuttle is pointing in the wrong direction, one option is to fire your thrusters and push the thing one way or the other. We only got so much fuel, and if you want to stay up for a long period of time, you're going to run out of fuel eventually. So what's the alternative? So the alternative is to have a little engine that twists the gyroscope, and that way when you spin the spin of your gyroscope, it changes the orientation of the spacecraft. So for long duration spacecraft, that's what they do. They have, like the Hubble Space Telescope, they have gyroscopes that spin up, and if they want to change the orientation of the Hubble Space Telescope, point at a different star. They don't use a rocket. They just spin the gyroscopes to point at a different direction. So yeah, you can have something that is spinning up your gyroscope, but it's going to end up spinning in the opposite way, of course, that the gyroscope is going by conservation of angular momentum. More questions? Oh, I got this toy I never played with. This is kind of a dull toy. This is just a big yo-yo. And like any yo-yo, what it's going to do is to convert gravitational potential energy into energy of motion, mostly rotational motion. And then it's going to be converted back into potential energy. It's going to come back as kinetic energy. There is a certain amount of friction, so it's not going to go on forever. But you can see that constant conversion between potential and kinetic energy present. Last questions. So kind of where are we? So for the current test, the culmination question was the big 10-point question that in the section. What will be the next 10-point question will be representing constellations. So what I will give you, not tomorrow or even this week, is I will give you pictures of dots. I'm not sure I have any examples here handy. I'll give you bunches of dots. Well, here's, I'm sure you can't see it. There are dots there. And soon I hope you will be able to recognize the corresponding constellations. So this is not an easy task. It's a whole lot easier if you have lines. If you have the shape of the constellation, you know, kind of like that, it's a lot easier to pick out the patterns. I'm not going to give you the lines, I'm just going to give you the dots. But I think it's helpful to learn them to look at the lines. So if you go online, there are kind of flashcard applications that you can do as either with lines or without lines, and you can practice these constellations. Having said that, everyone who's taken this class agrees it's a lot easier to do on the web than it is on the quiz. So you want to be kind of more than 100% on the web before you try these first quizzes. Why is it harder? Well, on the web, you've got really gross pixels per inch, right? So it's a pretty gross picture. And so the differences are really obvious. Whereas if you just have, you know, 600 dots per inch like you've got on a piece of Xerox paper, you can have much more subtle distinctions. So what's the bright star and what's the dim star? It's usually very obvious on the web. It's a little bit subtler when you're doing it in real life. So we'll do this the same way we did the other one. We'll start slow, few points, and we'll do this over, you know, four different quizzes or so, three constellations at a time. We'll do the simple ones first, and we won't start this for, you know, at least a week. So you also may notice that there's no reading yet. If you want, you can start reading chapter 5, but my take on chapter 5 is a little bit different. So what we'll be talking about next time is not going to be in chapter 5. We're going to talk about sound as an example of a wave instead of jumping right to light. So chapter 5 eventually, but maybe not immediately.